Ngau mai, whakaronga mai, ki te ao tai whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
Kia ora, I'm Duncan Smith. Great to have you with us. Today we're hearing about a scheme that's helping seasonal workers run successful businesses when they return home.
We head to the base of Mount Taranaki, ex-dairy farm pasture in a gullies producing bananas and pawpaw and plenty of greens, using home waste to nourish the land.
And later, a farmer in mid-Canterbury is getting his farm ready to host a vintage machinery extravaganza.
But first, to our look at conditions around the country. Northland's had plenty of rain. Often at this time of year, there are complaints about how dry it is. The market is strong for better bred cattle. Actually, most stock is selling well, and we're told farmers have wind in their tail feathers. Around Pukekohe, 25 millimetres of rain fell on Monday, followed by a light top-up on Friday. A looming problem early next year is likely to be unavailability or extreme shortage of crop protection products. International companies are having difficulty sourcing raw materials, and some manufacturers in China have closed. And to top it off, local importers are saying the prices of many horticultural products that are available are rising.
In Waikato, lambing is almost finished and seems to have gone well. When the weather's good, there are few losses. Beef cows have started calving. The feed situation is a bit tight on the hills. On dairy farms, the AI technician is still turning up every day to inseminate cows. They could stay for half an hour or a couple of hours, depending on how many cows are waiting in the shed. Soil moisture levels have lifted. They were behind in May but have caught up. A farmer deep in King Country says it's finally stopped raining and they're no longer walking around in mud. They're starting to wean their 460 beef calves. Docking's on the agenda for the end of next week. A Bay of Plenty avocado grower and packhouse operator says the majority of growers will be lucky to break even this year. Exporting's not easy with air freight and shipping issues, and Australia doesn't want our small fruit or our very large fruit, so a lot is being diverted to the local market. Fortunately, the last few years have been good ones for avocado growers.
Taranaki's had mixed spring weather with rain and sun, but it's generally wet. Some people are short of feed for their cows, and while others have enough to shut up for silage, not as many are closing up paddocks. Milk production's lower than normal. Farmers are still waiting for a week of sunny weather. Across the island, and Gisborne's had plenty of rain. There's been really good pasture growth, and that's welcome because stock came out of winter lighter than farmers would have liked. Strong prices mean farmers have a spring in their step. Good rain in Hawke's Bay in the past couple of weeks has really turned things around. Moist topsoils are boosting grass growth, but subsoil levels still have a way to go. Sheep farmers are thrilled with lamb survivability. It's been 10 to 15% more than you'd expect, given earlier scanning levels. That's being put down to virtually no rain over lambing.
Wairarapa needs sun. The days have been cloudy and dreary, and farmers and stock really want to see a big yellow thing in the sky. The sun really grows clover, and ewes that could do with more condition need a boost. Asparagus is in full production in Horo Whenua, but unfortunately, the inability to air freight it to international markets has meant growers won't be harvesting all of their crop. They'll be mowing some of it instead. The supermarkets can't cope with the extra volume, and there's only so much you can sell at the gate. Growers are assessing their options day by day.
Across Cook Strait, and it's still too cold and wet for Tasman to boast much grass. Another 50 millimetres of rain fell on Sunday, and the week's only been slightly warmer than earlier in the month, with the odd fine day thrown in. Farmers are becoming down over it because there's not the tucker for cows, and some are on once a day. Some farms and vineyards in Marlborough still have water sitting on paddocks. Our farmer contact had to run lambs through a foot rot bath because they were limping so much in the wet, they need heat and sun. Bud rubbing would normally be underway on grapevines, but the cold's holding them in check too.
Spring also remains elusive in Canterbury. There are continual bursts of rain, especially on the upper plains. Baleage and silage making is still off the radar, and while prices for meat and milk are great, costs have risen a lot, particularly for fuel and fertiliser. There wasn't a cloud in the sky on the west coast on Friday. In fact, it was the third sunny day in a row. Grass is now growing faster, and with a few supplements added to the cow's diet, they're looking good and getting ready for mating. According to our Karamea farmer, there's no better place than the coast on a sunny day.
Grass is growing in Otago and farmers are getting cows ready for mating, which means for some, inserting cedars so the cows all start cycling at the same time, so subsequent calvings condensed. Southland had a frost Friday morning, so they're not quite out of the woods yet, and last season's cropping paddocks still aren't regrassed. This week, our farmer here had a vet checking yearling Hereford bulls, which he'll use for the tail end of mating. 30% failed. They measure the scrotum circumference and it needs to be 32 centimetres or more. If it doesn't measure up, it doesn't mean the bulls won't be good next year. They're just too immature now. It's the second year our farmer's done this and he says it's well worth it.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
33 seasonal workers who have returned home to Vanuatu are taking part in an entrepreneurship program to help them establish or develop businesses. The program is funded by Australia and New Zealand and is being run by VLAB, Vanuatu's business incubator. VLAB's president, Marc-Antoine Morel, says it's the first program of its kind.
So we've got about a third of these entrepreneurs, you know, which have little businesses in the agriculture or livestock sector. So anything from, you know, raising pigs, poultry, or vanilla, or, you know, different sorts of farming and agriculture projects. And then the rest are businesses such as sewing, such as construction, furniture, video production. So a very wide range of activities.
It's all very well for people to come to New Zealand and to be able to earn money to take back to Vanuatu, but there is social disruption, isn't there? If they're coming and staying for months and months, it does have an impact at home.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's an increased recognition of this impact, amongst the employers and the countries that are employing seasonal worker. Hence the focus, I think, that is being given now on reintegration, and particularly economic reintegration, both to ensure but also to, you know, test whether once provided with livelihood opportunities and once they have set up small businesses that enable them to, you know, make a bit of money out of them, whether these people are still eager to go back to Australia or New Zealand. And what we found out, interestingly, is that amongst the seasonal workers that we are supporting, many, many of them have been telling us that because they now have this opportunity, because now they have this hope and future that they see in Vanuatu, they are no longer interested or willing to go back to New Zealand. But usually, you know, entrepreneurship and small businesses would come after they managed to secure enough funding for school fees and building of a decent house.
During the 10-month program, the returned seasonal workers are shown how to run and manage a business. Each is provided with a personal coach and they're given access to financial resources and networking opportunities.
You know, they are part of a group and they can rely on each other, they can share their experience, their challenges. And so this is something that we found was very, very inspiring also.
The name of the program is You, Me, Grow 'em, Vanuatu.
This is the name that they've chosen themselves, and which means let's build together Vanuatu. I think one important point to mention is that this is this is the first time in the Pacific region that there is such a program that is looking at the economic reintegration of seasonal workers. And obviously, given the success and the, you know, the stories that are coming out of this program, it is our hope that this will be extended to other countries of the region.
Merrily Ben has spent 3 seasons working in New Zealand. Twice she worked in the kiwifruit industry in Te Puke. The third time she headed to a vineyard in Blenheim.
So I decided to come for work for my daughter to be in school in 2008, because that's when for her first year at school. What happened is in 2012 was been too hard for me as a mother.
How many months were you in New Zealand each time?
The 2008 was only in 3 months. And then 2009, only in 4 months. And then the 2012, maybe it's 5 months.
So tell me about the business that you're trying to set up.
Okay. When I first came in 2008 and when I came back, one of my friends asked me to go and look after a small shop. And then I found out it's an opportunity to create my own. So since when I came back in 2008, I started that small business of mine until now.
Merrily sells handcrafts, baskets, jewellery and dresses. She says she used some of the money she earned in New Zealand to set up her business.
It really helped me and my family. And then it's a huge help for me. And it's a real good business.
What are you hoping that you'll get out of taking part in this new scheme through VLab?
So now I want to make more profit out of this one. Like I didn't realize that what I'm doing, it's a business. Because I only do it for money. But with the training that VLab gave me, it opened up my mind and I can see the real picture of what I'm doing. My customers now are my the local expatriate living in town here and my local Nivan customers.
What are your goals? What would you like to be doing in 2 or 5 years' time?
Okay, 2 or 5 years' time, I really want it and I look forward to have a real shop. You know, I want full room or something like that because now I set up in an open market. I want to have my own shop space. That's my idea for a long time.
Roy Tinning first worked in New Zealand 13 years ago in an apple orchard before he was transferred to Blenheim to work as a supervisor in a vineyard. Then he worked in recruitment.
When doing the recruiting, I came over to Vanuatu doing the recruitment and then take them to New Zealand, work with them, supervise them, and come back for another season during harvest season and pruning season.
Wow, so how many times in all do you think you've been to New Zealand?
Well, I work for the contractor for 9 years, from 2008 to 2016. I'm doing New Zealand Vanuatu 2 times a year during those years.
So that's probably 18 to 20 times you've been to New Zealand.
Yes, that's right.
Now, what are you doing at home? What's your business?
When I finished from the RSE, I invested my money in buying land. And I developed the land by doing agricultural work like cattle and coconut plantation. And then after that, my son was interested in the construction work. So I had to help him in setting up a capital for his business. So I now delegate the responsibility to them. They are now doing construction work and farming in the other part of the country, like up north. That's in Santo. From there, I moved to Port Vila. And from 2018 to now, I'm involving in planting vanilla.
What have you learned from the entrepreneurship program?
I learned about writing a business plan. I learned about the strength of the business. And I learned about how to manage risk, yeah.
What is your long-term goal? What would you like to see happen with your business?
My long-term goal is like dealing with vanilla. My aim is to flavor Vanuatu with vanilla flavor and to export vanilla. By creating a group product of vanilla so that we can export, and now I'm working on that for 2026 to 2027.
How much land do you have in vanilla?
I have about 1 hectare of vanilla, and I planted more than 500 plants of vanilla. And now I'm extending this project to the interested farmers so that they can plant vanilla and I can buy vanilla from them and processing for export.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, I appreciated the program and I appreciated the Australian and New Zealand government very much for their support.
Roy Tinning ending that report. You also heard from Merrily Ben and Marc-Antoine Morel.
If you're lucky enough to be able to get to Taranaki at the end of the month, look out for the region's Sustainable Backyards Trail, an annual event inspiring sustainable living. Bina Denton and Daniel Woolley are among backyard farmers throwing open their gates to show others how to grow their own food and live sustainably. Bina's an ecological landscaper and Daniel a healthy home specialist, and their business Greenbridge sponsors the event. Their 4-hectare property in a steep-sided gully near the base of Mount Taranaki is a showcase for their skills, and I had a sneak preview of it recently. I asked Bina how she'd describe the place.
I would call it an edible and productive garden. So we're on 10 acres and we've been regenerating it over the last 10 years, basically healing the landscape, because when we arrived here, there was not a tree in sight. So everything you see we've planted in the last 10 years. And my mission is to heal the land, really, and to be productive and grow food.
What was here before?
So it was a bare eroded landscape. It was dairy pasture before, and it was just rutted, lots of mud, very few fences, and it was blank canvas, but very challenging, which was both what drew us to it and almost broke us at the same time. So it's been a challenge, but we feel like we're finally getting there. There was a little bit of natural bush that was still here, Nahiri, but that was all eaten out by the cows. And so since we've taken the stock out, it's just all regenerated and all the little ferns have come back and you can hardly walk through there anymore.
Yeah, and that bush is now Kiwi2 covenanted, so that's in perpetuity, can't be logged or taken down.
Now this garden is stepped down, isn't it? The house is below the beds.
Yes, there is lots of advantages to putting it on a terrace or in the basin as we have done. It sits about a third of the way down the slope, so that's where there is a thermal belt, and you'll get it on any slope, even among a mountain. It's a spot which is warmer and more protected from winds and open to the north to the sun. So that's one of the advantages. But the other is that the waste from the house, so that's the black and grey water, so black water from the toilet and the kitchen, and the grey water from things like showers and washing machines, they go into an environmental system that feeds our food forest. And so just to give a little bit more detail on that, the black water goes into a big wormerator, so it's full of worms and that digests all the waste, and then all of the grey water goes into a slaterator. So that's literally, as it sounds, slaters with mulch, and that again digests all that waste, and together they go into a dosing siphon, and when that's full it releases on terrace, like on contour, and into our food forest. So it feeds all the orchard and the fruit trees.
And you must have a filter system, because black water is probably, as it sounds, pretty gross.
Yeah, so it's all legal and it's all passable by our local council. So we're very fortunate on our team. We have an environmental engineer, and she's a wastewater engineer, so she designed that system and she designs many others for our clients.
And it's worthwhile saying that that process that Bina's talking about, going through those pre-tanks, the slaterator and the black water tank, that is a natural filtration process, and when it's released actually under the ground, so you never get anywhere near it. So it's it might sound gross, but it's the same as any septic tank system, etc.
So we're heading over to the chook system, and I guess my more built infrastructure, where I have a straw yard for the chooks, and they create or generate for me all my compost, all my garden waste goes in there, and they've got a big mulch of carbon at the base there, and they get to eat their protein, because of course chooks will be much happier and produce lots and lots of eggs, as ours do, if they have protein. You know, naturally they're jungle birds, so they eat worms and slugs and slaters and things like that. So we're creating an environment which is as close to natural as possible, and they get a lot of their protein that way. We try to avoid industrial grains if we can, and there goes some chooks laying some nice eggs for us this morning.
Oh yes.
And so again, you know, talking about wastes and closed loop systems. So not only is our waste from the household, but all of the waste from any of our animals. And we site our animals as high in the landscape as possible, so that they passively, any nutrients that they generate, naturally go downhill. But also we help and expedite that process as well.
And so there's almost nothing worse to Bina than the chooks being out in the garden scratching it up. So they do come out, but when they do, they're in enclosed, closed systems that are helping to do work in the gardens.
Yeah, my daughter loves animals, so she built us this little system that fits perfectly over the veggie beds.
So it's like a movable chook house.
What we call a chook tractor. So they do get to come out, and we use the chooks as what you'd call biological control. So they will, eat any of the pests in the garden, and they'll dig the garden over for me, perfectly ready for planting.
The positioning of the garden here is largely due to that. We've got limited flat space on the site, but that means that when you're building your infrastructure, you're trying to minimise walking up and down hills as much as possible. That's why the terracing. And just thinking about if you've got to move a wheelbarrow of dirt or several wheelbarrows of dirt, you want that to be on as level a surface as possible, and so that dictates a lot of that. But also, like Bina says, it is actually really useful for nutrient cycling, and also thinking about how you're watering. If you're watering up the top, then that helps to actually water right through the landscape down below as well.
So it's using the water energy and the sun energy.
The human energy,
all of those, being very, very efficient with them and setting up your systems right from the start, which is what I love doing with my work, is helping clients create gardens that are actually efficient and work for them, because you can actually set up gardens for failure quite easily, and so if we can set up the right infrastructure and it's really efficient, you're just going to have a better chance of gardening.
Now, we're right at the end of winter and you have got a garden that is heaving with produce.
So it looks like a large space, but it's actually not. The annual veg is only 50 square metres, which we really pump and create a lot of, as you can see, lots and lots of food. But half of that at any time is in carbon. So that's growing brown stuff, essentially, like corn, amaranth, grains, etc., which I create my composts out of in situ in the veggie garden. So that feeds the soil. And again, it's that closed loop system. I don't buy in compost. I create my compost. But to create my compost, I've got to grow the ingredients for it. So it's a bio-intensive method. And storing carbon as well, and sequestering carbon, not only in the veggie garden, but in the landscape in general. So I'm a tree person. Don't get me started talking about trees. I won't stop. But I've planted probably around 5,000 to 8,000 trees in the last 10 years on the property. And a lot of that now is just coming to maturity and starting to sequester carbon. So that's a big part of our environmental solutions, I suppose.
And getting back to the food, the massive amount of stuff that you have growing here, you say half of it is to create the compost, but the rest of it, does that all get eaten by your family?
Yes, so like for breakfast we had soup. We don't eat cereals, so breakfast is often things like scrambled eggs and veggies or soup, those sorts of breakfast. So yes, I come out, this is my larder. I come out here every morning when I'm cooking breakfast or when I'm cooking dinner. Children, teenagers, they get to eat what they like during the day when they're away from
home.
How
do your kids feel about eating soup for breakfast?
I started them young enough, they didn't know the difference.
What sort of soup did they have? So this is an example here of another terrace that we walk down towards, which is really just an opportunity for both walking around the property at an easy gradient, but also these terraces are also water platforms, so they're slowing down the water in the landscape, and you can see there's a mound along the downhill edge, which means the water can't go beyond that, and so it tends to soak in into the land rather than running over the land and creating damage or getting too much overland flow.
Yes, because you, in a big downpour, you'd be worried about it all pouring into the house.
Not anymore. when we were first here, you possibly noticed when you parked, there's a large, what's called a swale around the top, which is stopping that's the first line of defence against big water when we're getting big rains. But there's a series of swales and paths on contour that are doing that job of stopping the water flowing overland towards the house, and also, but more importantly, soaking it in high in the landscape so that we're replenishing the groundwater so that we require less watering.
In Taranaki, because we've denuded the landscape and we've basically removed all of the nahiri in the bush, the water table has dropped from sort of surface level or just below to about 13 metres on average below ground. So we've lost pretty much all of our wetlands. We're around down to 2 or 3%. So it's really important that if you have the opportunity is actually to rehydrate the landscape through planting and things like swales. with different contours comes the opportunity of different habitats, and you can grow things in like subtropicals. We can grow bananas and tamarillos and avocados, but we can also grow deciduous fruit trees like pip and stone, apples, plums, pears, and we can grow Mediterranean because we have hilltops and
bananas. Yeah. So are we going to see any today?
Yeah, you can come and see some bananas, sure.
And I'll just show you before you walk away.
Probably around 4 years ago, we felt a real shift in the marketplace, I guess you would say, where sustainability was no longer fringe, but people began to understand it and unpack it. Again, we felt another shift and a rise in interest post the first COVID lockdown. The first day we came out of lockdown, the phones just didn't stop ringing. And people wanted to be able, they felt the scarcity and the, I guess, the anxiety of the lack of resilience in our food system, realising that a lot of our food, you know, coming from supermarkets wasn't reliable, and they wanted to be able to grow their own food.
And is this just the worried well-off, or is this a wide selection of people?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So we have a huge variety of clients, from those right at our base end where we just do really simple sketch designs to make it as bang for buck as much as possible for people, to, yeah, I guess you would say quite wealthy clients. Part of me sometimes struggle with that, but I think it doesn't really matter what your income is, you still deserve to be able to have that resilience and to grow your own food.
But back to the landscape. Yeah. The reason we
and we've come round, haven't we? And we're sort of on the side now of the gully.
We are, and now so we're on the west hand side of the basin overlooking the house, but from here you really get a sense of the terracing, which is why I stopped here to talk. So you can see the infrastructure of the gardens and the glass house and chook sheds, etc., above the house, terracing down to the house, which is that, as been said, that about a third way down the slope in the landscape, facing directly north. You can see we've got solar panels on the roof, and then each level terraces down from there to the food forest below.
And the fruit trees themselves are almost close to maturity, and I've planted the understory in there. So a whole range of very robust perennials, because they've got to compete with the weed seeds that are already existing in the landscape. So it's things like nasturtium, bishop's flower, which is cow parsley, lots of comfrey to fix the potassium for the trees. And you can also see the main terrace looping around those fruit trees, which is where that grey water system releases all its nutrients that we talked about before.
And that's your irrigation system.
That's right.
Absolutely.
So it's a passive irrigation system. So using human nutrient as a valuable resource rather than a wasted one.
Yeah.
People might think that you're going to pick up all sorts of disease, well, E. coli problems.
You probably don't want to grow carrots or potatoes or any other root vegetable in your black water and grey water. That wouldn't be a good idea. But this is a system that's feeding fruit trees. So that's going to the roots only. The fruit's growing on the tree. So it's completely separate. There's no opportunity. And the reality, a system like this is actually far healthier than a traditional system of a septic tank. So a septic tank holds on to the liquids and the water goes septic, i.e. not good, whereas this system doesn't hold on to water very long at all. It doses it regularly, and so the water's actually, although it may be black water and filled with nutrient, it hasn't had an opportunity to go nasty and septic.
So, are you going to take me to this banana tree, Bina?
Well, you can actually see the banana tree just peeking out the back there. So we're standing right now where my subtropical garden is. And subtropicals, if you just kind of think about the nature of it, they need very protected from the wind, they need filtered light and a high nutrient content in the soil. So I've got growing here tamarillos, avocados. At the back there is the banana. We've got sugarcane, pepino, pawpaw.
And an amazing variety of food growing there. The 6th Taranaki Sustainable Backyards Trail runs from the 29th of October to the 7th of November. And we'll put a link to it on our webpage.
Hi, I'm Robin Howe of Remarkable Valets, the cutest sheep in the world, and you're listening to Country Life, RNZ National.
Now we're heading to a farm near Ashburton in Canterbury. Cosmo is with Anthony Hampton, who is hosting a big event on his farm in 2022.
We're based here, well, sort of Lauriston Bar Hill area. I'm a grain and seed farmer. Over the winter months, we trade store lambs, but, yeah, basically crop farmers.
What's happening on the farm today, Anthony?
At the moment, we're top-dressing wheat with a little bit of nitrogen and just getting some odd jobs done. It's too wet at the moment to work tractors and cultivation.
Yes, yes. And we've got John here. Oh, well, I'm just come up to see Anthony, and I'm involved with the Mid-Canterbury Vintage Machinery Club, and this is where the rally is going to be held next April, so sort of been here involved with that. Tell me about the rally.
Oh, well, this is a Wheat and Wheels rally that we've last run in 2016. This will be the third one, and it's involves, well, vintage machinery, but also modern machinery, plus we have all vintage cars, trucks, anything with wheels, really. And the other main thing is we grow, oh, Anthony's growing some wheat for us to harvest, and I think there's 7 hectares, Anthony?
Yes, we've got 60 hectares set aside over the road there. 30 of that is in grass seed for this year, where we're going to have the main rally itself, the ring, all the displays, and the next paddock is in wheat, where we're going to have the harvesting display.
Over the 2 days, we'll use old combines to harvest like it used to be done, and also in the ring and things, there'll be thrashing with mills and chaff cutting, things like that.
John, how big is this event going to be?
Oh, well, hopefully we'll have 1,000 entries of tractors, trucks, cars, machinery. Yeah, it's pretty big. I think we're about at 6,000 people came last time over the 2 days. So we're hoping for that again. Yeah, so and people come from all over New Zealand. Well, actually, last time there's a lot of come from overseas, you know, all around the world.
Yes.
But, yeah, these guys drive their tractors from the North Island down to it and drive from Southland, Nelson. These tractors come from everywhere.
There is a reason why you are holding it on your farm, isn't there?
The main theme of this particular rally is the 175th anniversary of Massey, which is now Massey Ferguson today.
You collect Massey machinery, don't you?
Yes. I've got a few old tractors, and I farm with Massey machinery on the farm.
And a bit later on, we will have a wee look at your prized collection.
Yep.
Now, John, what's involved in organising a large event like this?
Well, it takes several years of planning, you know, especially with Anthony. He has to work his rotation of his farm to have the right paddocks, you know, and the right crops at the right time. Plus, yeah, there's a committee been working on this for quite a while. There's a lot of new things coming in now that's making it harder, whether you've got health and safety and traffic management. All these costs are really, yeah, it's not just like easy as like it used to be. So
yep,
it's quite a big operation.
So you do need a fair bit of money to run the event?
We do. Also, we're trying to involve the local community. I think the Lauriston School will be doing quite a bit of the catering, you know, selling, and also the Lions and different groups around the district all do well. Fire Brigade, we try and encourage the local district to be involved, and they'll be good fundraisers for them.
Where is everyone going to stay?
Well, Methven's only 14 k's up the road, and Ashburton's another 30 k's the other way. A lot of exhibitors bring their own worries behind their tractors and traction engines, and they stay in those.
You'll see the latest machines as well. Some of the things we like to have here, like the biggest combine you can buy in the world, is we're hoping to have here. There's several of these coming into Canterbury this harvest. Yeah. So we've got one of them lined up. We've got hopefully a big carrot harvest of self-propelled. We've got a massive sprayer. There's quite a few of these big sprayers. They're up to over 50 metre booms. So you'll be able to see farmers are about to, if they're not into old tractors, they'll be able to see the latest. They're too big to take to AMP shows this gear, so we've got the room for it.
And some of this machinery is very expensive too.
Oh, we're talking millions of dollars worth of machinery. Also, one of our favourite people like really is the big and small parade, where we have the biggest combine with the little old one in front, and same with sprayers or tractors. And already on the farm here has arrived for the rally is a Cat D9G, which weighs 60 tonne, and it's going to look quite impressive going around the ring in the crawler parade with a little Cat 10 probably running in front of it. So you see the difference between the big and the small.
And we can see that caterpillar here in the farmyard.
Yes, yes, that arrived up here 3 months ago, and the owner of that is doing some work on it now, preparing it for the rally. And then we've just got to drive it out to the paddock and when the time comes.
It's a beast.
It's a beast, it is.
Huge tracks.
Neat old machine. We've had it running, pushed a bit of soil and shingle round with it. And it goes very well.
Yeah, so just one of hundreds of different items of machinery that people will see in action next April.
Yes, it is. Mm. Yes.
I guess the only spanner in the works is COVID.
Yes, so let's just hope things have come right and we can carry on.
Tell me about the farm. How long have you been here?
I've been farming for just over 40 years. This particular place here I've had for over 30 years. And the place over the road where we're going to hold the rally is actually the first farm I purchased.
Yes, yes. And you're a third-generation farmer?
Third-generation farmer in the area.
What do you love about farming?
The outdoors and working with machinery. I do like enjoy machinery.
You've been collecting Massey machinery and vintage tractors for what, over 40 years?
Yes, I have.
Why? How did it start?
Well, it actually happened by default, where we're at a friend's place one day and they were showing off their nice new house they'd just built and a nice new set of stables because they were going into training trotters. And in between the two was this rusty old tractor. And when he asked me what I thought of the place, I said, you've done a marvellous job, it looks really good, but get rid of that old piece of junk, will you, sitting in between. And his reply was, if you're that worried about it, take it away. And I said, well, I don't really want junk like that around my place either. And I went home and I thought about it a bit more, what he had said, and I'd always liked playing with old gear. Trying to get it to go again. So it got the better of me. A week later, I rung him up and I said, you know that old tractor sitting there? And his first words were, when are you coming to get it? And that's how it started. I went and got it.
So how old were you then?
I was probably around about 30.
Did you renovate that tractor?
Yes, I did. We'll see that in the shed. Yes, I did renovate it, but as it normally goes, I ended up by buying another one to get parts off and so on, and then it started.
What is it about Masseys that you love?
Well, we've always run Masseys, and I thought, well, when I started collecting, we'll just concentrate on the one brand. So in the shed, there's Massey Harris, Ferguson, and Massey Ferguson.
I have a link to Massey Ferguson too, because on the dairy farm we had when I was a kid, we had a Massey Ferguson 135 and a 175 or 185. I think it was a 185. They were real workhorses.
Yes, they were, and very reliable. They gave Massey Ferguson a very good name, those old tractors.
We didn't have cabs. It was just jump on the tractor and get out and do some work.
Yeah. And no computers to play with either. They're still a very, very popular tractor. A lot of people are hunting for them, looking for them.
Fantastic tractors.
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's go and have a look at your collection.
Righto.
In a paddock beyond the farmyard, you've got three small Massey Fergusons. Are they part of your collection?
They're actually what you call anchor tractors. They sit on the end of an irrigator so it can be winched down the paddocks. I don't actually have pivots and laterals here because I couldn't bring myself to cut down all the trees that I've planted. So, yeah, I opted for another type of irrigator and I need a tractor to hold onto them.
So it just means you have to get out and do that a bit more than other irrigators would have to?
Well, we just can't push the button and let the machine go. We've made big, long runs, so we're not out there all the time shifting.
Yes.
Once a day shifts.
Now, your dog is following us.
It's actually my son's dog. I think he knows there's something going on, so he just likes to be involved. He's a Jack Russell.
He's quite a stocky wee fella.
He is, yeah. He's a good doer. Loves food. Pete.
Did you build this shed for your collection?
Yes, I did. Fully enclosed, bird-proof, just to try and keep them clean.
And beyond the shed, I can see a fire that's going. What are you burning there?
We had some trees blow over in the wind the other day, so we've been cleaning them up, and we just lit that up this morning while it's all wet around it and quite safe to burn a fire.
Yeah. And it's a nice day today, but you've had a lot of rain here, haven't you?
We've had just over an inch in the last few days, but it was very cold to go with it.
A lot of snow on the mountains.
There is, yes. Well down.
Okay, we are going in to the huge shed, which is packed full of machinery. And beside the door, there's a rather charming bar that you've made out of, what, wood that was milled on the farm?
Yes, big slabs of macacarpa. I was going to make a man cave out of a sleep out at the house, and not long after that, we had the Expedition South call in here, and we had quite a good night. And I said to my sons, I think I might make my man cave out in the shed. So that Christmas I was presented with these two big logs, or big slabs of macacarpa, so I could make a bar.
On a beam on the wall, there are two or three dozen empty bottles of whiskey.
It's a collection.
Now look at these tractors. In front of us are, what, 20 or 30 polished red massy tractors.
Oh, there's a handful here, yeah. Yes, that's my hobby.
There are some grey ones as well.
That's Ferguson. Massey Harris and Ferguson amalgamated, and that's where Massey Ferguson come from.
Tell me about the tractors that we can see. Give me a bit of a rundown.
Well, the bulk of them are Massey Harris tractors that I've found lying around and rebuilt them. Got to do it all yourself. Well, I enjoy doing it myself just to save costs. And, yeah, I get a lot of enjoyment out of it. Sometimes it takes a while to get a tractor done because it's the sort of thing you can only do in spare time, and you've got to keep the work up to date that pays the bills.
What is the oldest tractor you've got here?
The oldest tractor I have is a 1928 Wallace.
Let's go and have a look at it.
Which was the predecessor to Massey Harris. It's a Wallace tractor built by the Wallace Company, which Massey Harris purchased the rights to. And that's what got them into tractor manufacturing on a large scale in Canada.
In Canada?
Yes.
Now we're squeezing past tractor tyres to get to this 1928 Wallace 1220. Is this in working condition?
Yes, it is. It's in going condition. It can't do much work these days, and you don't want to be working them too much. I just drive them around, and that's about it.
Where did you find this tractor?
Another collector rung me up one day, and he said, oh, I found a tractor that you might like. He said, I actually bought it and brought it home from Culverton. And so I went and saw him, and we struck a deal.
What sort of condition was it in?
It was unrestored. It wasn't running. It had some undercoat put on it, which saved it from the rust. So I rebuilt the engine, went through everything else and painted it.
And it's got a crank at the front of the engine that you used to start it?
Yes, a crank handle. There's no electric start. The only electronics is a magneto, which sends the spark to the spark plugs.
What tractor here was in the most dilapidated condition when you found it?
Probably this green pacemaker here. When I got that, that was a ute and a trailer load of parts, and sort of had to build a tractor from that.
And that's a 1936 tractor?
Which is a continuation on from the Wallace beside it. I found that over by Lakeside in Canterbury. I spent 5 years restoring that tractor on and off. Not continually, but it was 5 years from when I got it till I had it finished.
Mm. And you've got another pacemaker beside it, a red one, which I guess is slightly newer than the green one.
One year newer and more streamlined. In 1936, worldwide, Massey Harris was struggling to sell 5,000 of this green pacemaker worldwide. So they thought they had to do something about it. They streamlined it, gave it a red coat of paint and styled it a wee bit more. And in 1937, they sold 20,000 of those tractors worldwide.
because aesthetically they looked a bit more modern.
Yes. Mechanically, it's exactly the same tractor. It's just a cosmetic different look about it.
You must have spent a lot of money, firstly, I guess, on buying all these old tractors, and secondly, renovating them.
No, not really, because when I started collecting, people didn't want these old tractors. So, close on 40 years ago, you could probably pick some of these up for about 50 ducks. I'd hate to think what they'd be worth nowadays. A lot of people want an old tractor.
They've all been snapped up.
They've been snapped up.
By collectors like you.
Yeah, yes. But they're still sitting around in farmyards and sheds, but some families don't want to part with them because it was their grandfather's tractor.
Gosh, well, let's walk down here. You've got your favourite pacemaker, the green one. Then there's the updated version, the red one. And then there's the Massey Harris 101, the 81, the 101 Junior.
Which was the very first tractor I ever got. That's the one that started the disease. And as yet, there's no known cure for it.
Further down, you've got the Colt, the MH50, the 44, the 55, the 745. There are so many different types of tractors.
The 55, when they were built, was actually supposed to be the biggest tractor in the world at the time. 1947, that tractor was built. And only about 20-odd 55s ever come in New Zealand because they were such a big tractor. Mm. They were like a broadacre machine for the United States.
When you finally get to start a tractor after you've spent sometimes years rebuilding it, it must be so satisfying.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Quite often one of my boys will be around. They've been interested in it too, so they're always wanting to know what's happening.
Oh, so you've got sons that are interested in these tractors?
Yes, I've got two sons. One's on the farm here with me, and the other one's a mechanic in his own right. Has his own business.
That's pretty handy, to have a son who's a mechanic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now, at the back of the shed, you've got machinery.
Machinery. It's all Massey Harris machinery.
What's that machine there?
An old hay baler.
An old hay baler. Oh, the old rectangular bales.
Yes.
I remember having to chuck the hay and straw onto the trailers.
Yeah. Hard to get someone to do that sort of work these days.
What else have you got here?
Oh, there's a plough, an inter-row cultivator, a combine harvester, silage chopper, mowers, we've got a side delivery, hammer mill, and what they call a gardener's cart over there. That was my mother's when she was a child. So mother used to go to school in that.
Tell me about your childhood. Where were you brought up?
At Bar Hill. On the family farm.
So just down the road?
Just down the road from here, yeah.
How old were you when you were first allowed to drive a tractor on the farm?
I think I was about 9. It was a wee Massey Ferguson 35. I was put out to mow some clover. Dad was following off the header, so he kept an eye on me. He said, you just keep following those rows and going round and round the paddock.
He would have been so proud of you. Did you do a good job?
I don't know. I was never told off, I don't think. I can't remember.
Now, you have an old McCormick binder that was used to cut oats and bind them into sheaves.
Yes. I got that off a farm down at Dorrie, and I actually used it for a number of years. I used to grow a lot of chaff before we put irrigation on here. And while we could get people that didn't mind that hard sort of work, it wasn't a bad crop to grow. And I used it every year.
Did irrigation change the way you farm?
Most definitely. I used to be a mixed farmer, which means I was partly crop and partly stock, breeding ewes and deer. And when the irrigation went on, the breeding ewes all went out the gate. That changed to store lambs over the winter months, and the whole place went into crop.
And in terms of farming at the moment, are things going okay?
Yes, yeah, they're okay.
What are some of the biggest challenges you are facing?
What the government are trying to do to us, really. Water reforms, that sort of thing.
What would you like them to do?
Well, they really should be consultating with farmers a bit more instead of dictating what's going to happen.
Yes. Do you have a succession plan for your farm and for this collection?
We're sort of just starting on that at the moment.
Yeah. Mm. Will all these tractors and bits of vintage machinery be out on display next year?
Yes.
During the Wheaton Wheels Rally?
Yes, they will. That's the reason for having it here, so I can just drive it out to the paddock.
In a way, this is preserving farming history, isn't it?
Most definitely. For grandchildren to see how their grandfathers used to farm with this early machinery. If we all let it go off to the scrap man, no one would know what it was actually like.
And that was Lauriston farmer and vintage machinery collector Anthony Hampton. Cosmo was also talking to Mid-Canterbury Vintage Machine Club president John Stewart. To see some photos from the day, go to the Country Life webpage. The easiest way to do that is to type in Country Life RNZ into your browser. And there's also a link to the Machinery Club's Facebook page in case you'd like to attend the rally with an old machine.
Well, that's it for now. Thanks for joining us. Kia kaha and ma te wa.
Bye now.